I want to take up in volume 12 at July the 11th, 1919, where Jesus speaks about the heavens of the soul. Louisa said, "I'm going through most bitter days. My beloved Jesus makes himself seen little or not at all, or like a flash and flying past. I remember that one night he made himself seen tired and exhausted, carrying as though a bundle of souls in his arms. And looking at me, he told me, 'Ah, my daughter, the slaughter that they will make will be such and so great.'" So he's talking about future wars. "That only this bundle of souls, that's a remnant, that I'm carrying in my arms will be saved. What madness has man reached? You," he said, "do not become disturbed. Be faithful to me during my absence, and after the storm, I will repay you with interest." "After the storm, I will repay you with interest for all my privations, redoubling for you my visits and my graces." Well, if you look at Psalm 57, verse 1, we are told to hide in the shadow of his wings until the storm of destruction passes by. We're in that position right now with regard to the COVID-19 virus. And so Jesus disappeared then. And Louisa says, "Another day, almost flying over in front of me, a light remained in my mind. And blessed Jesus, just as he has stretched out the heavens over our heads, so he has stretched out a heaven within our souls." So Jesus infused knowledge into her so that she would understand that just as there is a universe outside of us in the heavens, there's also a universe within us. And we find this difficult to understand. "And blessed Jesus, just as he had stretched out the heavens over our heads, so he has stretched out a heaven within our souls." Or rather, not one, but several, she said. "So there is the heaven of our intelligence." See, it's a different way of looking at things. "There is the heaven of our gaze. There is the heaven of our word. There is the heaven of our actions. There is the heaven of our desires. There is the heaven of our affections. And there is the heaven of our heart," just to take some examples. We're not inclined to use that image. "With this difference, however, that the external heaven," that is the heavens in the sky, "they do not change, nor do the stars increase or decrease, while the heavens of our interior are subject to changes. So, if the heaven of our mind thinks in a saintly way, as the thoughts are formed, so are stars, suns, and beautiful comets." Notice how responsible we are for creating these stars. So I want to give you Proverbs 23, verse 7, and 2 Corinthians 10, 5. That's the heaven of our mind. "And our angel, as he sees these heavens being formed, takes them and keeps placing them in the heaven of our intelligence." I want to give you Isaiah 26, verse 3. "And if the heaven of the mind is holy, the gaze is holy, the word is holy, the desire is holy, the heartbeat also is holy." So the gazes are stars, the word is light, the desire is the comet that extends, the heartbeat is the sun, and each one of the senses adorns its own heaven. I want to give you Leviticus 20, verse 7. So, notice the importance that's being placed on each aspect of our being. And I think it's very important to unite every single part of our being to every single part of Jesus's being in his holy will, so that every part of me adores, prays, blesses, honours, worships him all the time, at every nanosecond. On the other hand, if the mind is evil, nothing beautiful is formed, rather such darkness spreads as to darken all the other heavens, as the heavens of your interior. So the gaze sends flashes of impatience, the word thunders with blasphemies, the desires cast lightning of brutal passions, the heart unleashes from its bosom a devastating hail over the whole work of the creature. Poor heavens, how dark they are, and they arouse pity. So that message now is telling us that just as they are heavens and galaxies and stars and suns and everything else out in the world, the universe around us, so there is a universe within us as well. I remember many, many, many years ago, I would be talking about well over 55 years ago, hearing a most wonderful talk from a priest in which he explained that the structure of the human cell in the body is the same as the structure of the universe. And he took us on the most extraordinary tour from the cell of your body out into the heart of the universe as well. And just as the cell of your body has a nucleus at the centre, so the part of the universe that we are in has a cell in the has a nucleus in the centre, which is the sun. And the little bits that are going around the cell in your body, we have the planets going around the sun in the universe around us. I mean, I'm only giving you a tiny bit. I don't want to go on with this. But to realise that there are heavens within and heavens without. So August the 6th, 1919. The abandonment in God and the value of acts done in the divine will. Louisa said, I go through my days most bitter. My poor heart is as though petrified by the pain or the privation of the one who forms my life and my all. And although I am resigned, yet I cannot do without lamenting. I want to give you Psalm 73 and verses 25 and 26. So Jesus came and said to her, abandonment in me. This is the important thing, that we literally hand over ourselves lock, stock and barrel for time and eternity into the hands and into the sacred heart of Jesus. And we go from there to abandonment completely into his divine will. Abandonment in me, he said, is the image of two torrents, each one unloading itself onto the other with such impetus that their waters blend together. And forming gigantic waves of water, they arrive even to touching heaven, to the point that the bed of those torrents remains dry. And the roaring of these waters, their murmuring is so sweet and harmonious that heaven, in seeing itself touched by these waters, feels honoured and shines with new beauty. And the saints in chorus say, this is the sweet sound and the harmony that enraptures of a soul who has abandoned herself in God. How beautiful it is, how beautiful it is. Another day he told me, what do you fear? Abandon yourself in me, and you will remain surrounded by me, as though within a circle, in such a way that if enemies or occasions of sin or any kind of spiritual dangers come, they'll have to deal with me, not with you. And I will answer for you. Total abandonment in me is rest for the soul and work for me. At Psalm 131, my soul is like a weaned child on its mother's lap. total abandonment in me is rest for the soul and work for me. Jesus has told us, you desire it, I'll do it. So when we abandon ourselves completely to him, he takes over with great delight and becomes the life of our life, the light of our eyes, the love of our hearts, everything for us. If the soul is restless, it means that she's not really abandoned in me. A just pain restlessness is for one who wants to live out of her own will, doing great wrong to me and great harm to herself. So when we let ourselves go out of that deep calm, Philippians 4:7, the peace that passes all understanding and guards the heart and the mind in Christ Jesus, when we go out of that and come back into our own puny little selves, well, Jesus says that the restlessness you experience is a just pain because you've gone out of the eternal into the temporal. You've gone out of beauty into ugliness. You've gone out of grace into sinfulness. Louisa says, another day I was lamenting even more strongly, and my beloved Jesus, all goodness, told me, my daughter, calm yourself. This state of yours is the void which is being formed at the second preparation of the new chastisement that will come in the future. So now he's talking about World War II. That is the new big one that was coming. Read well into what I made you write, and you will find that not all the chastisements have yet happened. This is Amos 3:7, that the prophet is told way ahead of time. I mean, if you consider that Isaiah wrote the most extraordinary things about the Christ 800 years in advance, the people of his own day must have thought he was just simply dreaming or using his imagination to entertain them. But in actual fact, he was telling them the most extraordinary things about the Christ. So Louisa is being told way in advance what is going to come. He said, read well into what I've already written to you. That is in volumes 1 to 11, because this is volume 12. And you will realise, he said, that not all the chastisements have actually happened. How many more cities will be destroyed? And think of the number of cities that were destroyed in the Second World War. In Germany and Japan, just to take two examples. The nations will continue to draw up one against each other. And Italy, the nations which are friends with her will become her fiercest enemies. Therefore, patience, my daughter. When everything is prepared to call man back, I will come to you as before. And we will pray and cry together for ungrateful man, ungrateful for all that God has done for us in his three fiats. You, however, never go out of my will. For since my will is eternal, what is done in my will acquires an eternal, immense, infinite value. You need to colour that in your book. You need to underline it. This is very important. What is done in my will acquires an eternal, immense, infinite value. It is the currency that arises and never runs out. So this is the divine currency that we can change everything into and let it have an eternal value. The littlest acts done in my will remain written with indelible characters. Isn't that fantastic? And they say we are eternal acts because an eternal will animated us, formed us and performed us. Now notice, if an act originates in the human will, no matter how good it is, it's a human act and utterly limited. But if the act originated in a divine will, that's completely different. And so they're able to say we are eternal acts because an eternal will animated us, formed us and performed us. It happens as to, it's the same as with a vase of clay in which liquid gold is poured, and the goldsmith formed from that liquefied gold forms objects of gold. Is it perhaps that because that gold has been liquefied in the vase of clay, that is said that it's not gold? No, gold is always gold. So what Jesus is saying is that in the ancient times, they used to liquefy gold, pour it into clay pots. We would say molds. They would pour it into clay molds. That's correct. And so they would bring out this extraordinary shape once the gold would solidify again. So Jesus is saying, if divine acts are done inside of us, because we're only clay, we're only dust. We were made from the dust of the earth. So if the divine acts are made in us, that doesn't change the divine acts. Just as those clay molds or models didn't actually change the nature of the gold itself. No, gold is always gold, in whatever vase it might be liquefied. Now, the vase of clay is the soul. My will, he said, is the gold. The act of the creature of operating in my will combines my will with hers, that's the gold and the clay, and they liquefy together, that's the fusing. And from that liquid, I, the divine goldsmith, form the acts of eternal gold. Now notice, only the Lord can do that. All we can do is fuse, enter into him, tell him what we want. And he will do it. So I want to give you 2 Corinthians 4:7. I, the divine goldsmith, form the acts of eternal gold in such a way that I can say that they are mine. And the soul can say they are hers as well, because we have fused together. So we continue the value of fusing in the next section, September 3rd, 1919. Louisa was lamenting about her poor state, and Jesus came to her. She was wondering what was the purpose of her life, since she was only agonizing in a bed and it appeared as if she was achieving nothing. And Jesus said, "My daughter, the purpose of your life is known to me. And it's not up to you to investigate it." Now, we always want to know everything. We want to understand everything. We want to feel that we're in charge of everything. We don't like surrendering our entire being into the hands of anyone else, even if it is God. Oh, we say we do it, all right. But if we did, we would all be saints. And Jesus asks Louisa not to rationalize what is actually happening, but just simply surrender. So there's the clay in the hands of the potter, which is Jeremiah 18. And it's also Romans chapter 9. The clay must surrender into the hands of the potter and let the potter make whatever he or she wants from the clay. So Jesus said, the purpose of your life is known to me, and it's not up to you to investigate it. Know, however, that your mere fusing yourself in me every day and several times a day serves to maintain the balance of all the reparations. Look at that, how important it is that we must fuse with the Lord many times a day, the more often the better. He said, because when you do this, it serves to maintain the balance of all the reparations, because only one who enters into me, that is infusing, and takes from me the origin of everything that she does. So we take from him the origin. That means it's going to be divine acts, and therefore they're going to have an eternal value. And she takes from me the origin of everything she does. Only that person can balance the reparations of everyone and everything. That's the only time we can actually offer him the reparations of all souls, past, present, and future. This soul can balance the glory of the Father on the part of creatures. because since in me there is an eternal origin, an eternal will, I was able to balance everything. Satisfaction, reparation, and complete glory of the Celestial Father on the part of all. Now, the Church has always told us that it's through him, with him, and in him that we do anything. So Philippians 4:13, I can do all things in Christ who gives me the strength. But without him, I can do nothing. That's John 15:5. So, as you enter into me, that means you fuse in the divine will. You come to renew the balance of all the reparations and of the glory of the eternal majesty. And do you think this is little? Don't you yourself feel that you cannot do without it? And that I do not leave you if before... Let me read that again. Don't you yourself feel that you cannot do without it? And that I do not leave you if before I do not see you fuse yourself in all my single parts to receive from you the balance of the reparations as you substitute in the name of the whole human family. We have to fuse not only in a general sense, but when we want to do something particular, Jesus said, you must fuse yourself in all my single parts. And so when you go to the Hours of the Passion, for example, you'll meet Louisa making reparation to the divine head, face, mouth, ears, eyes, shoulders, body, hands, feet, everything. And she's doing particular reparations in each thing. Try as much as you can, Jesus said to her, to repair me for everything. So that means you go through the whole crucified person. If you knew how much good the world receives when a soul, without a shadow of personal interest, but only for love of me, rises between heaven and earth, and united with me, that is fused with Jesus, balances the reparations of all. Now notice the thing that he has emphasized literally from volume one. And that is, we must come without a shadow of personal interest. There's nothing in this for me. The motivation we have is only love for him. So I don't come with any personal interest. I only come because I love him and I want to do everything that he wants me to do. And so notice the motivation has to be right. Everything has to be right if we are to actually achieve what we're setting out to do, which is to do eternal acts and to make reparation for everyone and everything. September the 13th, 1919. One must die to one's own life in order to live the life of Jesus. Now, this is the thing that Jesus has to keep coming back to in order to try and get it to register with us. And that is, if I want to live my own life, my own way, doing my own thing, forget about it. I'm not in divine will. If I want to do my own thing a little bit and give him a little bit, that's not it either. I'll go in and out of the divine will like a yo-yo. If we truly want to live in the divine will, I've got to let my own life surrender. I've got to let his divine life take over. That's the issue. Don't put that off. The sooner you do it, the greater the harvest. Louisa said, my bitterness grows and I do nothing but lament to my sweet Jesus. Have pity on me, have pity on me. Don't you see how I have reduced myself, she said. I feel I've no more life, desires, affections or love. All of my interior is as though dead. Ah, Jesus, where in me is the fruit of your many teachings? And while I was saying this, Jesus came near, she said, binding me over and over with strong chains. That is pulling her deeper and deeper into the divine will. He said, my daughter, the surest sign, here again now, here's a bit of discernment. And the thing I love about these writings is that you are given discernment as you go along, so you can check where you're actually at. The surest sign and the seal of my teachings in you is that you feel nothing of your own. The old life is dead. And besides, isn't the living in my will precisely this, to lose oneself in me? We even sing that, lose yourself in me and you will find new life. That's Galatians 2:20. How can you go on searching for your own desires, your own affections and the other things if you've lost them in my will? Once you hand over a gift, that's it, it's gone. It's finished. My will is immense, he said, and it takes too much to find them. In other words, they're not gone. They're merely surrendered to the divine will. And in order to live in me, that's to live a surrendered life, completely one with him in his divine will, it is befitting to live no longer out of one's own life. Otherwise, you show that you're not happy to live out of the divine life and you're not completely lost in me. So there's a little bit of discernment. You can find out just how much you have surrendered to the Lord, and how happy you are to let him actually take over. I've come across people who do a 9-day novena to surrender to the Lord. My reaction to that is, get on your knees. And if you're not able to do it now, ask our Blessed Mother to come and help you, to bring you into that now, not in 9 days' time. And ask Jesus to take over. September the 26th, 1919, the effects of living as in the state of a victim. So Louisa continues her lamentation, and Jesus said, my daughter, one who is a victim must be exposed to receiving all the blows of divine justice and must feel within herself the pain of the creatures and the rigors of these pains that they deserve from divine justice. In other words, when you look at Jesus on the cross, Jesus perfectly mirrored the state of unredeemed man physically on the cross. He was not free. He was nailed. He was covered in wounds from head to foot. That's the image of a leper. He was blinded by his own blood, sweat and tears. He was deafened by the pain that was in his head and the insults that were coming at him from other people. His heart was broken. And you could go on and on and on. He perfectly imaged the unredeemed man. And he took that all on himself, because Romans 5:5 says that he became sin for us so that he could bring us through in every single part. Now, Louisa is being told that as a victim soul, she mirrors the way that humanity is deprived of the presence and the grace of God. So when she feels cold and hard and sort of dead inside, that is actually the condition of the unredeemed humanity that she is being a victim soul to try and save. And she needs to come to realize, actually it's wonderful when you go into the higher volumes, because she's got over this problem. But here she's still coming to try and come to terms with the fact that what she's feeling is not herself, that she is at one with the divine will and she's at one with the heart of Jesus. So she has to experience in herself what he experienced coming from the desperate death, the spiritual death that was in humanity around. So when she sort of feels darkness, that's the darkness that's in the world. When she feels cold, that's the coldness that's in the world. If she feels hard and she can't do anything, that's the hardness that's in the world. And that's the very stuff that she's got to bring to the Lord and turn it into intercession. Jesus said, "Oh, how my crushed humanity moaned under these rigors. Not only this, but from your state of privation and abandonment, you can see how creatures are with me, and how divine justice is about to punish them with even more terrible scourges." Man has reached the state of complete madness. Now, that's a century ago. You just wonder how he would describe us today. Man has reached the state of complete madness, and with madmen, the hardest lashes are used. Now, why would he say the hardest lashes are used? He's not thinking of madness as an illness. He's thinking of the absolute insanity of society living in a way that the only future it can have is hell. It's complete madness. So he's not talking about any kind of an illness. He's talking about the worst possible spiritual illness we can have. And when we get to that stage of absolute loss of wisdom and understanding, it's only chastisement that we'll get through. Louisa said, "Am I Jesus? My state is too hard. And if I did not have the enchantment of your will, which keeps me as though absorbed, I don't know what I would do," which is correct, because I mean, she's sitting in a bed 24/7, 365. Jesus replied, "My justice cannot take satisfaction from two." That means if he's chastising the human race, he cannot ask Louisa to make reparation as well, because God is just. So if he allows Louisa to make reparation, he is going to either mitigate the chastisements, or some part of humanity will not experience them. And you will see this if you go to the book of Revelation, because you're told in many of the chastisements that one third of humanity was affected. Not two thirds, not three thirds. "My justice cannot take satisfaction from two, and this is why I keep you as though suspended." In other words, if he deems that the chastisement does more good, then he will leave Louisa suspended and he will do the chastisement. But if there's still enough good in humanity that the intercession will bring about some change in them, then he will allow Louisa to do it. Now, notice the way he's looking all the time and making decisions as he goes along. "But since when I wanted you to put yourself in this state, there was also the concourse of obedience. Now obedience wants to still keep you in it, and this is why it continues." So Jesus says that she has been under obedience to the church through the priests and her local bishop from the very beginning. And since they want her to continue to act as a victim soul and to intercede for everybody, then God concurs with that, because God is the very one who gave the church its authority. And so he will not go against the church making a legitimate decision. "However," Jesus said, "this is always something before divine justice, that the creature wants to do her part." In other words, we have the privilege, and he actually wants it, to pour our drop of water into the wine of his redemption. "You, however, do not move in anything." In other words, keep up your commitment and keep up your intercession. "And then you will see what your Jesus will do for you." So I want to give you Exodus 14, verses 13 and 14. I want to give you 2 Chronicles 20, verse 17. And I want to give you 1 Samuel 12, 16. So now we go on to October the 8th, 1910. 19, and this is a very, very, very important message. It is the effects of confidence in God. Now, I've told you before a number of times that St. Therese of Lisieux told us that you will get from God as much as you have confidence in him to receive. No confidence, you get nothing. Total confidence, you get everything. The basis of all relationships, all, I should say, all healthy, correct relationships, is trust. And the basis of our relationship with God is trust as well. So Louisa says that she continues in her usual privations and Jesus is almost in silence, but she's all abandoned in him like a little girl. That's your Psalm 131. My soul is like a weaned child on its mother's lap. And then Jesus spoke to her in her interior. And he said, "My daughter, confidence in me is the little cloud of light." Notice light. "In which the soul remains so enveloped as to make all fears, all doubts, all weaknesses disappear from her. Because confidence in me not only forms for her this little cloud of light that enwraps her completely, but feeds her with the opposite foods which have the power of dispelling all fear, doubt and weakness." Now, in these days of COVID-19, we need that message hugely. And Jesus says to us in these days, "Hide under the shadow of my wings until the storm of destruction passes by." That is Psalm 57, verse 1. Do we hide, just like little chicks hiding under their mother's wings, and they're completely safe and they trust completely that the mother knows what she's doing? And Jesus is telling us to do that as well. In fact, Jesus said, "Confidence in me dispels fear and it nourishes the soul with pure love." Now, what we need to make progress in the divine will is pure love. It dissolves doubts and it gives her certainty. It takes away weakness and it gives her fortitude. Even more, it makes her so daring with me that she attaches herself to my breasts and she suckles and suckles and feeds herself. And she doesn't want any other food. So there you have the child completely at rest in its mother's arms, Psalm 131, and suckling away, not worried about nuclear war. So she suckles and suckles and feeds herself and doesn't want any other food. And if she sees that in suckling nothing comes to her, and that I allow this in order to excite her to even greater confidence, she neither gets tired nor does she detach herself from my breast. On the contrary, she suckles more strongly and she knocks her head against my breast and I laugh and I let her do it. Okay. I want to give you Luke 18, verses 1 to 10. Jesus said that when he doesn't appear to respond to our trust, he's not asking us to give up. He's asking us to go deeper. And in Luke 18, verses 1 to 10, you have the poor widow with the unjust judge. And the more she was repudiated by him, the more she came back until she eventually set up house on his doorstep and wouldn't move. And he couldn't leave his house without stepping over this body. And in the end, even an unjust judge would give her what she needed, just to get rid of her. What an incredible story. Because it's at absolutely the other end of the scale, infinitely at the other end of the scale, that the Lord, when he doesn't respond to us at any particular moment, that we just go deeper and we start saying to him, "I choose to trust you beyond reason." And that is extremely important for us as we go on in the spiritual life. And notice I said, "I choose," I'm using my highest faculty, my will. "I choose to trust you beyond reason." I'm not going to rationalize about it. I'm not going to go absolutely scared with all that the media are saying about anything. I'm going to trust you beyond reason. And the Lord just loves that because it gives you an opportunity to grow in more trust. And it gives you an opportunity to glorify him as well. So the trusting soul, he said, is my smile and my enjoyment. One who has confidence in me loves me, esteems me, believes in me, and knows that I am rich and powerful and immense. But on the other hand, one who has no confidence doesn't really love me. She dishonors me. She believes I'm poor, powerless and small, and what an affront to my goodness. We don't realize what our lack of trust is actually saying, do we? October the 15th, 1919. The living in the divine will brings the state of security. Notice this now. Insecurity, living in your own will. Security, living in the divine will. And that security is not just temporal, it's eternal. Continue in my usual state, Louisa said. She was thinking, how can it be I'm so bad, I'm good at nothing. With the privations of my Jesus, I have reduced myself to such a state as to make even the stones cry. And in spite of this, she said, watch this now, here's the evidence. I've no doubts, no fears, either of judgment or of hell. You see, there's the stability that has been brought. It's fantastic. So what the Lord does with Louisa in teaching us is that he lets her have an experience and then he explains it so that we can learn from it. So in spite of everything that she feels, she has no fears, no doubts, and she doesn't worry at all about either judgment or hell. So Jesus said, my daughter, as soon as the soul enters into my volition and decides to live in it. Now, notice there are two things there. One is that you confuse and make an act in the divine will and then go back and live your own will. The other one is to fuse in the divine will and decide to stay there, to live there permanently. For this one, the one who decides to live there permanently, all doubts and all fears depart from her. I mean, what would you be afraid of? Death is merely the gate to glory, and the worst thing that human beings can do is kill you. So what do you fear? Nothing. Satan can't get near you, because he would be burnt to cinders with the divine will. So it's like a daughter of a king, who no matter how much people might say that she's not the daughter of her father, she pays no heed to them. On the contrary, she goes on proud and says to everybody, it's useless for you to tell me the contrary, to put fears and doubts into me. I am the true daughter of the king. He is my father. I live in him even more. He is the his very kingdom is mine. Now, you'll get the opposite of this if you go to John chapter 7 and 8, where Jesus is having huge discussions with the leadership of Israel at the time when he was on the earth. And he has to say to them, your father is the devil. The works you're doing are the works of the devil. The way you're speaking, the way you're acting, everything says you're coming from that source. And where I'm coming from is my Father in heaven. And everything that I say and everything that I do shows you that I'm coming from him. So who you are is manifested in every breath you take. Every movement, everything tells you, tells God, tells the world and tells Satan who you are. And so he says, if you're the daughter of the king, it doesn't matter what Satan or the world or any, even yourself says. So among the many goods which the living in my will brings, it also brings the state of security. And of course, if you're in a state of mental and spiritual security, you're not in a state in which you can get sick. It's very interesting. And since she makes what is mine her own, how can she fear what she possesses? If everything that the Lord is and has in the divine will is mine because I am living permanently fused in the divine will, what is there to fear? Therefore, fear, doubt, and hell get lost, and they cannot find the door, they cannot find the way, they cannot find even the key to enter into this soul. Wow, there's eternal security for you. There's happiness, there's joy, there's peace. There's the peace that passes all understanding, Philippians 4:7. And we can have it now. There's no need to put it off until tomorrow. Even more, as the soul enters into the divine volition, she strips herself of herself. Now, the big key by which you will know, the big key by which you will know whether you've entered into the divine will is that you've stripped yourself of yourself. You've laid down your ego before God. You've laid down your self-will before God. You've laid down even your good human will before God. You've laid everything down. There has been total surrender. And at that point, the human will clicks into the divine will in an absolutely permanent way. Because once I surrender completely, he will take over completely. And I will know, because my life will change absolutely from that moment. So she strips herself of herself, and I clothe her with me, with royal garments. So I clothe her. Remember the prodigal son in Luke 15? The father clothed the son who came back to him. With royal garments, that's the garments of grace and salvation, and also the sheer dignity of being a true child of God, Romans 8:19. And also, I want to give you Psalm 45, verses 14 to 17, that describe this royal condition. And these garments place on her the seal that she is my daughter. That's your Romans 8:19. Now, do you remember Joseph and his technicolor dream coat in the second half of the book of Genesis? Okay. What most people don't realize is that coat that Jacob gave to his son Joseph pointed him out as the chosen one, the elected one, the beloved one, the one who had a special mission vis-a-vis his brothers. And as the story unfolds, you realize that he had the mission not only to save his brothers, but to save the whole world at the time of a frightening famine. So these garments represent your calling. When a woman who is a commoner marries a prince, from the day of her wedding, she's dressed in royal garments because she enters into a royal state at that particular moment, and she's never a commoner again. It's the same with us when we surrender absolutely into the divine will, that we leave our commoner state behind and we enter into a completely new state with the Lord. Jesus continues, "My kingdom, just as it is mine, is hers." Because this commoner, now being the bride of the king, she shares the kingdom with him. And defending our rights, he said, she takes part in judging and in condemning others. Wow. For that, I want to give you 1 Corinthians 2:15. 1 Corinthians 6:2. Therefore, he said, why would you go fishing for fears? This is terribly important at the moment when I'm actually speaking, that people in the divine will do not fall back to the position of fear and fright that other members of society have when you have the privilege of being the bride of the king. Also, this taking part in the judging, I want to give you Revelation 5:10 and also 2 Timothy 2:12. That's quite a good few scriptures on that one point. But I wanted to give you a number in case you think it was very unusual. So let's go to November the 3rd, 1919. Participation in the pains of the state of victim of Jesus. So Louisa has been told that in her interior state, she feels the awfulness of the sin of the world. Now she's being brought into identifying with the passion of Jesus. I was worried, she said, about my poor state. The pain of his privation petrifies me. And I do remain calm, she said. So I want to give you Psalm 73, verses 25 and 26. But I remain calm and all abandoned. Now, this is the thing we're really going to emphasize from here on in, the all abandoned bit. We have to remain all abandoned in him, no matter what happens to us or what state we find ourselves. Heaven seems closed to me, she said. As for the earth, I've not even known it for a long time. And if I don't know it, how can I hope for help? So, I've not even the sweet hope of hoping for help from people of this poor world. If I did not have the sweet hope of my Jesus in my life in, as my all, my only and sole support, I don't know what I would do. Now, notice that we hope for help from people of this world, and we're much more inclined to do that than hope in the Lord. And Louisa says here that in the present state of aridity in prayer that she has, she appears to have nobody in heaven or on earth. Okay, but Jesus is her only and sole support. That is Deuteronomy 32:12. So Jesus came, she said, and placing his holy hand on my forehead to give me strength, he told me, poor daughter, daughter of my heart and of my pains, courage, do not lose heart. Nothing is over for you. On the contrary, when it seems over, notice this now, when it seems to be over, then it begins. Just as we are at the end of an era and everything is chaotic in the world today and everything seems to be finished or finishing or just about to finish, and instead of that, what is actually happening is that the new era is very quietly getting on its feet and will gradually take over. Of all that you think, Jesus said, nothing is true. Now, I don't know about you, but that consoles me enormously. Louisa is a great saint. Probably you'd have to put the word great in letters that are about 2 feet deep, because of her absolutely unique and extraordinary relationship with God. And it's the sheer frequency in which Jesus tells her, but what you're saying doesn't make any sense. The way you're thinking is not right. That, I find that enormously consoling. Because we're living in a society where you're supposed to be absolutely perfect. You're supposed to understand everything. You're supposed to be on top of your game, blah, blah, blah. Not at all. So I want to give you Isaiah 55, verses 8 to 10, in which the Lord says that my way of thinking and your way of thinking are as different as the heavens are from the earth. Watch how different Jesus' thinking is to Louisa's. She says she feels everything is over. She feels that there's no help for her in anything. But she said something very interesting that I want to point out now. She said, heaven seems closed to me. Well, if you go to Deuteronomy 28:24, that is the lot of rebellious humanity. And here Louisa is not still recognising that what's happening inside of her is representative of what is actually happening in the world. So Jesus is going to explain it to her. He said, "Of all that you think," he said, "nothing is true. On the contrary, your present state is nothing other than one point of the state of victim of my humanity." Now, notice the one point. You're only getting a little bit of it. Okay? It's only one point because we can't take much. We're only tiny. Jesus was able to take a lot because his humanity was married to his divinity. "Oh, how many times my humanity found itself in these painful constraints." He said, "My humanity was identified with my divinity. Even more, it was one with it. And yet my divinity, which held all the power over my humanity and demanded from my humanity expiation for the whole human family, yet it made me feel the denial, the oblivion, the rigors, the detachment." Now, you need to really colour this. The divinity made Jesus feel the denial, the oblivion, the rigors, the detachment, which all the human nature deserved. In other words, he had to experience their punishment. He had to experience the reason why divine justice would actually strike. "These pains," he said, "were the most bitter for me. And the more identified I was with the divinity, the more painful it was for me to feel the detachment from being united," which is, of course, what Louisa said up there, that heaven seemed closed to her. "So the more painful it was for me to feel the detachment, which while being united, to be loved and to feel forgotten, to be honoured and to experience denial, to be holy and to see myself covered with all sins." You see, that's the victim position. What a contrast. What pains. "So much so that in order to suffer this, there was a miracle of my omnipotence." Now, my justice wants the renewal of these pains of my humanity. And who could ever feel them if not one whom I had identified with me? Now, from volume one, Jesus has been telling Louisa that he wants her completely identified with him. "Honoured so much to the point of calling her to live at the height of my volition." The height means the summit, the highest that a human being can go. So this soul is honoured so much to the point of being called to live at the summit of the divine will. Isn't that extraordinary? "In which, from the centre of the divine will, she takes all parts and all generations, and she unites them together and repairs me, loves me, substitutes for all creatures. And while she does this," notice that while she does this, "she feels the oblivion, the denial, the detachment of the one who forms her very life." So while she's doing this extraordinary work for souls, she also feels abandonment from God. "These are the pains which only your Jesus can calculate." He's the only one who went through them. "But in certain circumstances, they are necessary to me, so much so that I am forced to hide you more within me so as not to let you feel all the bitterness of the pain." So he says, certain circumstances, these are the really bad times. He has to hide Louisa more deeply within him so that she actually feels all the bitterness of pain. "And while I hide you," notice she hasn't gone anywhere and he hasn't gone anywhere. The union remains. "I repeat," he said, "what my humanity did and suffered." So Jesus is acting in and through Louisa all the time. She just needs to come to understand more deeply extraordinary nature of what's happening to her. "Therefore, calm yourself," he said. "This state will end. to make you pass on to other steps of my humanity. Now, notice it's a journey, and when you succeed in passing one exam, you will be brought to the next stage. Well, that's what happens in school all the time, isn't it? You put a child into school at the age of four, and nobody's ever satisfied with what they learn. When they manage one year, you shove them to a higher level and a higher level and a higher level. And then they graduate from primary school and you shove them into secondary and they become a junior, having been a senior. We don't realise that what happens to us spiritually is mirrored in our everyday life. And when they manage to work their way through the secondary school and they graduate from that, then they become a junior in the university. So each level has important stages to it. But then when you get to a higher level, you start all over again. And it appears as if you haven't got anywhere. In actual fact, you have. Because you wouldn't get to the secondary if you hadn't passed through the primary. You wouldn't get to the university if you hadn't passed through the secondary. And so he said, when you feel that you can take no more, abandon yourself more in me. Now notice the secret is deeper and deeper abandonment. And while you feel your Jesus praying, suffering and repairing. Oh, sorry. And then you will feel your Jesus repairing and suffering within you. And she will talk about that as we go on in these volumes. And he said, but you are to follow me. Now, isn't that exactly what Jesus said to Peter at the end of John's Gospel in John 21, when Jesus told Peter what was going to happen to himself? And then he said, and what about John? And he said, never mind what happens to John, you follow me. And this is very important for all of us. We can waste time looking around to see what's going on in other people and how other people are getting on. And we can forget to go forward ourselves. He says, no, your duty is to follow me. And this is very, very important in these terrible times that we're going through, that the most important thing for God and for humanity is that we will follow the Lord absolutely, faithfully, unconditionally to the end, even if that end is martyrdom, and most especially if it's martyrdom. And you, he said, follow me. I will be the actor and you will be the spectator. And when you are cheered, you will take the part of the actor and I will be the spectator, and so we will alternate with each other. Well, that's the story of footprints. That you walk together with the Lord and then there's only one set of footprints, and when times are bad, he carries you. But in the divine will, he said, you might carry me as well. I find that fascinating. So in the divine will, there's only one set of footprints anyway. And they're all the footprints of Jesus, because Jesus has already told Louisa that if I carry you, I'm carrying Jesus. And if you carry me, you're carrying Jesus. So in the divine will, there are only one set of footprints. And I want to stop there for a while.